President Trump continues to tell everybody that he is working on a deal to end this war. He is working on a deal that will ensure no nuclear weapons for Iran, that they will not have control of the Strait of the Hormuz, and everything will be wonderful as long as they agree to this, or bad things will happen. Problem is, when you start looking at all parts of this equation, lots of confusion and lots of contradictory information. We're going to get to the bottom of that today. We're also going to talk about potential for nuclear war in Europe, something that seems to have just been taken off the table and is not even a realistic possibility, but we may see it's a little bit more serious than we think. And we have nobody better to talk about that today than somebody who's actually written on the topic here recently, and that is Alistair Crook, former British diplomat and MI6 officer with decades of experience in the Middle East, European security affairs, and has also served as a senior advisor to the European Union. And as you're about to see, he's also the founder of Conflicts Forum, which is on Substack. Alistair, welcome back to the show. Really
Thank
great to have
much.
You on for a couple
Thank
of
you.
Reasons today. But let's jump right into the first one here, because there's an interesting article out here recently in The Atlantic, which by Robert Kagan, who up until recently had been a pretty big war hawk, but now all of a sudden he's kind of turned into, I mean, dare I say it, a realist and looking at reality. And he writes in The Atlantic here, I think it came out yesterday, Trump is seeking a letter of intent, and for, before that, it was a memorandum of understanding. It seems like all these different phrases, but they keep changing. But nevertheless, he says that would formally end the war and launch a 30-day period of negotiations on Iran's nuclear program and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. The purpose and effect of such an agreement should be clear. The United States is walking away from the crisis. Trump may launch another limited strike to look tough and falsify or satisfy the demands of his supporters. More on that in a second as well. But it would be a performative gesture. Endgame, in this case, is a euphemism for surrender. But let me look at each of these three things here, because he's saying, look, we want to formally end the war and launch a 30-day period of negotiations. I mean, you're a British diplomat. I'm thinking, wait, if you're going to enter into negotiations, that's not an end of war. That's not a permanent anything. That's just a ceasefire to have negotiations. How do you read that part?
I agree with you exactly. The document that we've seen that little doesn't address any of the major issues. It just proposes, there are many questions about it. It says that Hormuz would be reopened under a joint supervision. Joint supervision with whom? And what does reopening mean? I mean, it's just a sort of bland document. I think there's something important here that I just want to convey, because, you know, we always get these sort of, you know, stories suddenly emerging either from Axios or from Al Arabiya that the deal is, you know, a document is just about to be agreed. And then a little while later, then we're told it isn't like that at all. I just want to say something, because I have some experience of this and I've lived in Pakistan too. But I mean, this is how it works. Actually, what happens, there is no face-to-face negotiation. People are not talking to each other on this because the Iranians don't trust that way of doing business through mediators. They want everything in writing, quite wisely. So it has to come in writing. Then whether it is Munir or some other Pakistani official, would then hand it over to the Iranians. Iranians would write a response, carefully choosing each word, hand it back to the Pakistanis to convey to the Americans. It's not a sort of a discussion. And so sometimes this gets, if you like, in their enthusiasm for being a mediator. Sometimes mediators put a gloss on things or try and promote it. Remember that the Pakistani military, like the Pakistani Field Marshal, has no political base in Pakistan at all. He is a military person who's acted, if you like, in an irregular way. The popular leader of Pakistan, Imran Khan, was imprisoned and ousted at the behest of the United States, because he took a neutral stand on the war in Ukraine. And so this person who's there has nothing other than the support of the United States. And so he is naturally seeking to please the United States. So probably drafts get written and get presented as if they're from the United States or what he thinks people would like him to hear in the United States, or perhaps they come from the United States with sort of input, verbal input from them. But it is just simply a post box. So a piece of paper goes one way and a piece of paper goes back the other way because of the experience of being misled. The Iranians have a long experience of being misled that things are said to be, oh, yes, we had a little earlier. Oh, yes, we had, you know, oh, yes, sanctions can be lifted during the talks. Yes, it can be a ceasefire and this can happen. And it turns out that, you know, there are no real concessions from the United States. And I would say where we are at the moment is still at the same impasse. The Iranians remain with their 5 points of the prerequisite conditions to enter into negotiations. And America, Trump's position remains the same. He wants the enriched uranium. He wants Hormuz opened without tolls. And so there's impasse at the moment. And mostly these negotiations that we're seeing were mostly actually more about manipulating markets, manipulating the oil price and the futures market, trying to get it down so that Americans don't worry about gasoline prices. It's all about markets keeping the equity market up. So it's all about manipulating markets, really more than substance, I think, at this point.
It's and, you know, just your point here, this is out last night, which is breaking. This was last night in the Middle East, 2:45 p.m. in Washington. Then an Iranian source close to negotiating, he says, claims of a final draft of a U.S. agreement are false. What a shock that is. The talks are in permanent deadlock, to the contrary. And that was when early in the day, X was just alive with all kinds of people saying, oh, the two sides are almost agreed to. There's about something to come out. And then people, the Iranian side, of course, said, what are you talking about? There's not even any negotiations. How are we almost at a solvent, whatever, that it finally comes out. Now then, today, let me run back to this article here real quick, because I think it's important. Is according to Robert Kagan here, he says the United States is basically trying to walk away, to do the walk away theory that we've talked about before, but that Trump may launch another limited strike to look tough on his way out. So first question is, if that happens, is there just a little shot that the U.S. could blast away at Iran just to cover their tracks as they walk away, and Iran would be, all right, no problem, go ahead and do that and walk away? If that's not the case, what do you think Iran would do if he tries to do that?
They've said it very, very, very clearly. They are not prepared to have, if you like, we'll do a little bombing of that, and you can do a little bombing of this, and we'll call it a day. That's happened in the past, but they have made it very, very clear. If there is any attack, as soon as that attack starts, there will be a massive response from Iran on the infrastructure, the bases in not just the Gulf area, American bases there, but more. The Iranians have said very clearly, this time we will widen it beyond the Gulf area to other places. They haven't said which places, but they've said it's going to be a much wider war, and it's going to be with different weapons, and it is going to be a very intense war. At the moment, Iran is basically expecting an escalation and thinking that all of this, probably these talks have suddenly, you know, that there are negotiations in hand and so on out of the blue. All of this is sort of to throw them off balance in preparation for an American massive attack on Iran and Iranian infrastructure. So they are all prepared and are expecting, fully expecting at any moment, a war may come. Whether it will come or not, no one can tell, because this all lies in Trump's head, essentially.
Well, now let's take a look at, speaking of Trump's head and his inner circle, I'm going to show you something here from Marco Rubio, a video that was just released this morning. If we're trying to have some sort of negotiation, Iran has categorically said, I think working with Oman, they basically already have a system set up, a toll booth and whatever we want to call it today, and that the enriched uranium is not even on the table. In fact, the whole nuclear program is not on the table until the war gets settled, and then later they'll talk. That's what they're saying. Here is what Marco Rubio is saying America's position is.
Those conversations that are ongoing, there's been some slight progress. I don't want to exaggerate it, but there's been a little bit of movement, and that's good. The fundamentals remain the same. Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. And to achieve that, we're going to have to address the issue of enrichment. We're going to have to address the issue of the highly enriched uranium. And then added to this, of course, is the issue of the straits. Iran is trying to create a tolling system. It can't happen. If that were to happen in the Straits of Hormuz, it will happen in five other places around the world. Why would countries all over the world say, well, we want to do this too?
So how can you even plausibly say we're making some progress, not that much, but then the fundamental things on America's side are unchanged, the fundamental things on the Iranian side are unchanged, and they're not bridgeable in the current form? What do you make of that?
Well, you saw exactly the point that I'm making about why there's so much manipulation going on. He said we're having conversations, there's a little bit of progress. There are no conversations. There are pieces of paper that are carefully worded, that are exchanged between the two sides. But it's not the case of a sort of toing and froing discussion, and let's have a bit of this and a little bit of that, because the Iranians have been burnt by that before. And so they're not going to accept that sort of, you know, well, maybe we can, maybe it will be lift sanctions incrementally. Oh, yeah. They've heard that many times before. And were sanctions incrementally lifted? No, they don't believe so. So the impasse is exactly where you say. You're upright. They have now instituted an authority for Hormuz Straits. It's operating. It's got a website even. You have to fill in some forms and you pass them through, and between Oman and Iran, they can pass. And if you don't like the word toll, well, the Iranians say this is an environmental charge and a security charge, since you don't like it. But I don't understand why Rubio has got such a thing, saying, oh, tolls, no, impossible. What do you think people pay when they go through the Suez Canal to get into the Red Sea? Do they not pay a toll? Panama Canal, do you not pay a toll to go through these areas? Do you not pay a toll when you go on a motorway? I do here. Every time I have to go on a motorway, I get used to paying tolls. So, I mean, you know, these are normal facts of life.
Well, it seems to have been that way. Or it is that way now. Never was before, never would have been had we not started this war. I think that is crystal clear to most people, but not all people. There are still those who want to have a different outcome. And my question is to you right now, before we're going to shift over to another topic here, where can this go? As long as we keep talking about stuff that's just not even reality, and Iran keeps saying, here is the reality, deal with it or not, I'm going to continue to go down this path. Where can this go? And let me just show you real quick. There's here in the U.S., you have the likes of Mark Levin in the upper left-hand corner, who's a big advocate. And you can see from his post here just last night, it's time to destroy the Iranian regime. Now he's like saying, you know, forget it. Not even any niceties. Let's just destroy them. Forget this and get it done. The clock is ticking. Meanwhile, you have on the other side here, that's just from this morning, the Iranian source says that the whole issue is about Iran wants a 30-day trust-building period before you'll do anything, which is just not going to happen anyway. So we just seem to be at a complete impasse in reality. So where can this go in the near term?
Well, this is precisely why the Iranian calculus is that Trump, for all sorts of reasons, going from the Israeli crisis at the moment, and Israel is in a form of crisis, and the headlines in the Hebrew press are very clear. Netanyahu needs a big war. It says that. It's also in the even in the English language press. Everyone in Israel understands that Netanyahu is in a deep crisis. His government may come apart because of a conscription bill. It's weakening. There's all sorts of stories about it. May even blow up before elections. I.e., elections will come perhaps earlier. It could blow up any time. The military are telling Netanyahu that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, is collapsing. It cannot continue. It's just overstretched. Morale is bad. Discipline is breaking down. The troops are looting and killing and doing criminal acts. And the army is losing control over this. And all of this is leading to a severe crisis. So that's at one level. The other one, of course, is that Trump, his ego and his whole career has been built on being a winner and not a loser. And so coming to an agreement, which isn't so much better than the JCPOA that was negotiated by his unesteemed rival Obama, is not acceptable to him. So the only alternatives really is that he goes to all-out conflict, because a small conflict, he's been looking for a small conflict ever since Venezuela. And we do a quick Venezuela in Iran, and his team and the Pentagon come back and said to him, no, that isn't going to work. This isn't Venezuela. This is Iran. It's not going to happen. So either he goes to a big war, or he has to do what I don't think psychologically he is capable of doing, which is to concede Iran's basic demands. And then it would be possible to move on to other issues. But until he gets there, I don't think it's going to be possible. The Iranians, and there is something that, again, just to stop this confusion that goes on that I keep seeing in the mainstream press, the decision that Iran will not give up its enriched uranium, the 430 kilos of 60% enriched uranium, to anyone, including to Russia, it will not be exported abroad, is an order from the Supreme Leader, Mujtaba. And I just underline, because people keep talking about, I see headlines in the press even today, Pezeshkian says this or that. Pezeshkian is not in the same position as an Iranian president is not in the same position as an American president. The commander-in-chief of all military and security forces in Iran is the supreme leader. And that is through the Supreme National Security Council. The president is responsible for domestic affairs, not foreign policy and not defense policy. He sits, of course, on the Supreme National Security Council, but he's just one member, or his governments are just part of the forum, which also contains the IRGC. So the person managing the war and making the negotiating decisions in conjunction with the Supreme Leader is an IRGC general, and that's Khalibaf, who's a respected and revered IRGC member. He was mayor of Tehran, and a popular mayor of Tehran, and he was a presidential candidate. So he has standing and weight. He is the main negotiator, but the final decisions. So when it's been ordered by Mujtaba that it won't go abroad, that's the end of it. It's not going to go abroad until he changes that decision, and that's not likely. So, all this talk about, maybe, mediators can shift the position and, you know, persuade Iran that it can give it up as a goodwill gesture to Trump, a ladder for him to climb down the tree. I mean, it won't happen in the light of the decision, because he is the absolute commander of the military and security policies of Iran.
Well, you know, I want to shift to a different point here, because that seems to be at an impasse. And what I'm about to show you is going to show why it's even less likely to get solved than it might even otherwise seem, which is already monumentally difficult, because President Trump himself is setting impossibly high objectives to meet. But in this clip here, this is actually going to transition to the second part of our discussion here about nuclear weapons. And he's talking here in the context of the Iranian situation here, but the theory and the idea about why they're so scary, or should be so scary, but I don't think are in reality, is what would happen if they landed on an American city.
I'm not doing this politically. I'm doing, look, everyone tells me it's unpopular, but I think it's very popular. When they hear that it's having to do with nuclear weapons, weapons that could take out Los Angeles, could take out major cities very quickly. When they hear that, you know, when they're explaining, I'll tell you what, when we explain it to people, I don't really have enough time to explain to people. I'm too busy getting it done. When they understand, I think it's frankly very popular.
Number one, that's nonsensical what he's saying. It's not even a coherent sentence as he keeps stopping. But he's trying to say, look, because Iran would nuke LA or some crazy stuff like that, he says, you should be afraid of that. So that's why we have to take care of this situation here. But you've written a piece in your conflicts forum here called Paradoxically, Fear is the Foundation of Stability. Deterrence works. And the core issue you said here is, yet the core issue remains unchanged from half a century ago. Strategic stability ultimately rests on credible nuclear deterrence, a sufficient arsenal, and the demonstrated readiness to use it if necessary. Intimidation, however uncomfortable the world may be, remains the foundation of peace among nuclear powers. First of all, just what prompted you to write this article? And then we're going to get into some of the details here. And I guess just a question that I have is, it seems to me that the world at writ large, but definitely the United States, has lost its fear of nuclear weapons about what happened in 1945. It seemed to really predominate in the thoughts of politicians around the world, even in the United States. And that seems to be lost now. Now it's almost just like a tool to use to let me go attack Iran. How do you see that?
Well, this really stemmed in that piece that you've just put up by me, arose from a paper that was written by Professor Sergei Karaganov, who is both an academic, but also a long-standing political figure in Russia. And why it's so important what he's saying is because, first of all, the substance to his paper, it's been dismissed in much of the West as something that's a bit fringe and something that we shouldn't take too seriously. Well, I'm saying it actually has a lot of substance in it. And secondly, it's important because actually the views expressed in this paper and repeated by Professor Karaganov in innumerable interviews on television and other things are now at the center of Russian politics. They're not an outlying idea. They have become the mainstream view. That's why we should take this proposition very seriously. And what it goes back to, and when I'm saying that, it's because I've had direct, I've discussed this directly with Professor Karaganov, and I have some, therefore, idea of, you know, the background to it, because it comes from my direct conversation with it. But it is about the sense, which you just mentioned, that whereas Russia did have, if you like, a deterrence, a nuclear deterrence in the 50s, which they had created a great trouble because they were in the Cold War, if you like, and that they felt the need to defend themselves and to create a deterrence that would be deterrent, that would deter. And it was that in the 50s. And then, of course, after the implosion of the Soviet Union, much of that disappeared. Russia was obviously much weaker, but the deterrence lapsed. And what Karaganov has been saying very much is the problem is that people don't take our deterrence, because, of course, Russia still is a major nuclear power. They've just had a demonstration of that in this recent time, a massive demonstration of their nuclear forces. So it is a nuclear power. But you've probably come across it, as I have. You know, if I say, oh, well, you know, if you push this too far, you may find that there will be a reaction from Russia. Oh, no, Alistair, of course not, because, I mean, the Russians would never dare to do something like that. They wouldn't. It's all bluff. It's just bluff from Moscow. We don't take this serious. This has been a constant refrain from American and European neocons throughout this period. It's all bluff. They'd never use it. We can go on building our nuclear forces and even think again of nuclear primacy because Russia really will never do it. They're too cautious. They would never use a nuclear weapon. And Karaganov said to me, and he wrote it in this report, you know, this is a very dangerous thing for the world to enter into a position where they think that Russia will never use its nuclear forces under any circumstances, however provoked, because they don't fear it and they think everything is just bluff and we can just go on taunting Russia, we can go on escalating against Russia, and there will be no consequences. And what we have seen, and we see this very visibly, and why it's so important now, is we've seen the Europeans particularly ratchet every few months, it ratchets the pressure on Russia. First of all, it was drones inside on the borders of Russia, Belgrad or some area. Then there were drones going further afield. Now we have the case that drones are landing in Moscow in huge numbers, even though they don't do that much damage. But they are there and they have an effect on the public and in St. Petersburg. And of course, it's justified as sort of damaging Russian energy infrastructure, and it isn't. It really isn't. It does a little damage to some refineries, but they are quickly repaired. It is a provocation more than a strategic weapon that is being used. And we're getting to the boundary where this is no longer acceptable and will result in some sort of direct response from Russia, because not only are these missiles flying directly into deepest Russia, but they're flying through NATO airspace, through Finland, through the Baltic Republic, through the Baltic states, directly onto St. Petersburg, onto the refineries there, because they can fly almost entirely through NATO space and then just emerge near to St. Petersburg, and therefore use NATO space. And the reliance on the sort of Article 5 that NATO would never be attacked by Russia because Russia would never dare to do such a thing, relying on that to get around Russia's air defenses and to spring up right on target at St. Petersburg or Moscow. And it's now going stage by stage, and now it is getting too much. And at the same time, we've heard constantly from Europe this refrain, war, war, war. Prepare for war with Russia. Prepare for war, the German leadership say. We may have war even by 2027. We may have war at any moment with Russia. even though, you know, you look around and you can see quite clearly, Europe hasn't got the capacity for war with Russia. It hasn't got the money to finance a war with Russia. It hasn't got the troops for a war with Russia. So why are they saying it? They're saying it because they hope to provoke through Ukraine and through, if you like, using these Baltic states, they are hoping to provoke Russia towards action against NATO states. And then that they intend and hope that maybe with this administration, or if this administration becomes a lame duck or disappears from office, then they can reverse everything. They can bring America back to Europe, because Trump has been taking NATO and America away from Europe. Now we can bring America back.
So, Alistair, let me ask you, bring America back to NATO. This is a hugely important point here, because I've heard this before, when there are those in the West that want to prompt a Russian strike in there, because then that will allow things to reverse, as you said. But you laid out in the phrase right before that the NATO writ large, I mean, forget about UK, France, Germany, I mean, the big powers, they don't have the troops, they don't have the air power, they don't have the industrial capacity. So why would you want to prompt something? You may not survive long enough for America to come back and join. Why would they take that risk?
Because they are trying to do it, if you like, bit by bit, to, if you like, to sort of assuage the Russian response, the deterrent, until they can get pull back America to join. You know, after all, this was laid out clearly. This is the policy of Germany, France, and the UK. King Charles went to Congress, and you recall what he said there. America must join with Europe in preparing for a war with Russia. What? Who wants, whose interest is it to have a war with Russia? But nonetheless, he was speaking on behalf of his, I mean, also the government policy and the policy of those Euro 3 that are wanting to move, to bring, just as in with Roosevelt, to bring, you know, America into a new war with Russia. That at least is how Russia sees it. I know, because I've heard it. They believe, they say, but Alistair, you know, you say that the West isn't capable of fighting a war with Russia, but every moment, every day, we hear them talking about a war. They're now talking about a sort of Baltic arc in which Russia will be engaged. They try and engage with tankers and with other elements. And it's a ratchet, one ratchet at a time, another ratchet, until the moment is right when they hope, if you like, to engage a new administration in Washington or other to come and join with Europe in a war. You may ask, say, it doesn't make sense. Why would this be going on? Well, it's been going on for 200 years. That's why. When you look at the determination of certain forces in Europe, financial source forces, deep state forces have been planning this, financing, if you like, the Japanese war against Russia in 1905 that weakened the Tsar, financing the Bolshevik Revolution, financing, if you like, the near takeover in the 1900s of Russia by the Harvard boys and their resources. All of these things have been going on for a long time. Russia is acutely aware of the sort of deep, long-running hostility and the desire to weaken and destroy Russia. Whether you say it's misplaced, exaggerated, or whatever, it is beside the point. That is how Russia sees the picture. This is the psychology. And that is what was disturbing Professor Karaganov, because he said, if they don't fear our nuclear weapons, then they will go on ratcheting and ratcheting up until we are at war. So we have to bring back a certain degree of fear. That's why there is that sort of paradox, as I called it, or the oxymoron, of actually a nuclear fear can be the source of stability, particularly at a time when arms control has largely disappeared. All that, we talk about arms control, but it's meaningless. I mean, it hasn't been in existence for a long time because it didn't suit the United States to go on with arms control because they wanted to pursue a conventional war through Ukraine against Russia. In that way, then the arms control limitations would continue even as they were pursuing that war. And just take an example of this. This was very apparent. You remember when there was that spiderweb attack on Russia's strategic nuclear aircraft on the tarmac. They were there because of the SALT treaty. They are supposed to hold their strategic bombers out in the open so that satellites, American satellites, can verify that they're still there and something hasn't changed. So they're kept out in the open. And that was the basis of that attack. It failed. It didn't work. It went wrong. But they had all of these containers and these vans brought into Russia with sliding roofs so that the missiles could be fired from the vehicles and hit the strategic nuclear force of Russia. Why would the United States think that this was a good idea? Because clearly it wouldn't have happened without the United States support. Why did they think if it was a good idea to attack its strategic nuclear power? Why would they have attacked in Voronezh, if you like, with their TACAMs, which is where Russia has its over-the-horizon radar systems at Voronezh? These are over-horizon about intercontinental war. They're not anything to do with Ukraine whatsoever. These are the radars that are to give early warning of a nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia. Why attack those? Why attack the nuclear strategic bomber? Now, you can say, oh, don't take it seriously, it's not so important. But, I mean, if you're sitting in Russia and Moscow and you understand the significance of this, yeah, you will say, are the Americans, you know, moving towards the preparing for the idea? They've already said publicly, the official responsible for it, that they believe American can win a nuclear exchange with Russia. And then that attack on Valdai, the Valdai compound, that also happens to be, if you like, the center, the control center, an underground bunker control center. It has the house of Putin there too, but it also is the command center for nuclear forces in the event of an exchange with another adversary.
You know, I'd like you to, because I think that you said something a minute ago that I think is so important for us to understand. We think Russia would never do this because they see Article 5, 32 NATO countries against one Russia. They would never survive that, so they never will. So we can do those things safely. But I want you to help us to understand the Russian mentality as exposed by Professor Karaganov, as you mentioned here, because he said one interesting thing I found very interesting from your article. This is what you put in there that he wrote. The use of nuclear weapons is a great sin, but the de facto refusal to use them is an unforgivable, deadly, and criminal sin because it paves the way for expansion and escalation of the world war unleashed by the West. If it is not stopped, it will most definitely lead to the destruction of humanity, including our own country. Vladimir Putin's question, and what is the point of a world without Russia remains relevant. So when he says using nuclear weapons is a sin, but not using them is a greater sin, to what extent does that, impose on Putin's thinking, and how widespread is that in Russia?
First of all, I mean, what he said too, and this is important to understand, because this directly affects particularly Europe. And he said, listen, we must understand the lesson from Iran, how the Iranians have used conventional weaponry, missiles, carefully chosen on vulnerable assets of the United States and Israel and the Gulf states. And that caused them to retreat. That brought a retreat. And so what he's saying is the first layer has to be conventional, Oreshniks. And he says we must build a range of missile capabilities for the future, Oreshniks, Bereshniks, all of these things for conventional power. But at the back of it always has to be some sense of real fear that there is ultimately, if none of those things work, the nuclear, I mean, the absolute last resort is a nuclear use. But to rule out or to allow that deterrence to fall away, to come into a disuse, is a danger. And I happen to think also that actually it is in a European interest for Russia to have a deterrence, because otherwise we will slowly, slowly, step by step, end up possibly in a major war with Russia by these little steps that Europe is taking every time. You know, first of all, it was drones, then it's attackums. They wanted to use Tomahawk missiles. Now they are using massive drones that are made in Britain, made in France. The actual drones or assembled in Ukraine, but made in Britain. These are British, if you like. Who's behind the plan? And this is why I'm saying it goes back to the decision makers. Who is behind this plan to do this escalation, to use the Baltics and Finland? You know, the Baltics are just, you know, minor in this. The big question Russia is looking at, who is the decision makers? And the decision makers are in Germany and in Britain and in France that are planning this slow escalation. You know what it's called. This is what the Russians think is happening, is that we are trying to boil the frog. You know the story. You boil the frog, you put the frog into cold water, and as you slowly increase the heat, after, you know, degree by degree, in the end, the frog dies. And so they think that this, what is happening is a sort of boiling the frog exercise of escalation, small escalations. And so I think if this goes on, this is just my personal view, but if it goes on, I think there will be a reaction against the decision makers who are behind it. I mean, we know quite clearly it's not a surprise. They've already said this. And we don't know, exactly where the, I don't know where the missiles launched from, but Naryshkin has said that they are actually being, that the Ukrainians are in Latvia with these drones. I don't know. Naryshkin is the head of the intelligence service, so he probably has quite good information. But even if they're not, it's not so much what's happening in the Baltic states. And there are, you know, threats to take in, to go to the Kaliningrad Peninsula or anything like that. It's who is they have to, as they see it, have to send a painful and clear message to decision makers. Those decision makers are largely in Europe. It's European-driven, this move towards war with Russia. But just like as we've heard about, you know, the war on Iran, you know, the question is, why would it be in a European interest to go to war with Russia? What for? How could it be in a European interest? Well, it has been a European interest for a long time. From, the war Europe has been fighting Russia. I mean, from Germany, it was from Napoleon, from Germany. Britain was the only one who was not, but Russia had almost the entire of Europe fighting it in the Second World War. And, you know, they don't intend to be boiled in the pot. So they are looking for ways, conventional ways, like the Iranians have done, to send a very clear message, that in that case, sending a message to Washington saying, look, you know, pull back, because otherwise we will escalate and it will be extremely damaging for our economies, your economies, the world economy. And if you don't listen to the message, draw back, pull back from this exercise in Iran and pull back from this attempt to slowly escalate into something much more serious
Let me ask you a little follow-up question on what you just said there, because I hear what you're saying about why, because the obvious question that any normal person would ask was, why would the West, Europe, U.S. want to do this boil the frog thing to try and move closer to a conflict with Russia when Russia clearly does not pose a conventional threat to attack the West on their own initiative? So there is nothing to deter or limit from coming from them. But as you pointed out, I mean, you went back to Napoleon, to Hitler, et cetera. There seems to be this longstanding desire in the current form, because we've seen World War One and World War Two and the massive destruction. And now with the destruction power profoundly higher, any third attempt would be massively more in casualties for Europe. What is animating the individuals today to even want to play with the boil the frog theory?
You ask a very complex question, but really it goes back to things that have happened in the past. It was called the Pale of Settlement, and it led to a huge immigration. First of all, to a radicalization of population that were in these pales of settlement, which were mostly in Poland, led to quite a radicalization in the Pale of Settlement. And many of those people arrived in America, but also many of them went to Palestine, to Israel, and many came to Europe, and those people were part of a generation of young people who were radicalized, really radicalized, against the Tsar and against the government in Russia. From the 1860s onwards, it became, you know, the younger generation rose up against their parents, essentially, and became Trotskyists and became Bolsheviks, and were throwing, you know, nail bombs into cafes in Russia. But then Stalin came and repressed it, and, if you like, sent people to the camps in Siberia. And there's a huge anger and resentment for what they call pogroms before. I'm not saying there weren't pogroms, but many of them were not, you know, the pogroms that took place or claimed to take place in Ukraine. Many of them were actually done by the Greeks, who resented competition and things in these areas. So there's a sort of deep history of desire for revenge for what happened during the Stalin period and after the Bolshevik Revolution. And this has been long standing. And, you know, Europe financed the Bolshevik Revolution. European banks financed the Bolshevik Revolution. They financed the war against Russia, the Japanese war that defeated Russia. they financed the Ukrainian, if you like, war against Russia. And ultimately, you know, this is at the forefront of the screen for many Russians. They see this and understand it. It's not sort of our take on the world, and we say, you know, well, is it real? Is it something that we should take seriously? Well, I think we should take it very seriously. I've always felt, you know, that the most important thing in geopolitics, which I try to practice too, is to put yourself in someone else's shoes and see the world not just from your vision, not from the inside, but from the outside. So the, you know, and the huge change that can take place politically and in geopolitical understanding is when suddenly for a moment you see actually the inside has an outside and the outside is a different view. And that if you've got to understand that to find a solution to the apparent contradiction of holding opinions and views that are facets that are completely contradictory.
And as long as we fail to do that, I mean, you have all kinds of problems because we live in this, I don't know about in Europe as much, at least in the United States, we live in this virtual reality. We program in what the other side is, and then we wear these goggles, and we don't even see what really is going on, which has pretty bad consequences.
So this is, and the consequences could be very serious with this. If we ignore what, you know, and you said, is the paper by Karaganov serious? Yes, I'm trying to say to you, this is, you know, yes, when he first started talking about this nuclear issues, it was considered to be a little bit out of an outlier. It is now dead central. This is the thinking. This is why the Russians have just had a major nuclear. This is the first step. A major, look at it. It's been a massive demonstration of nuclear power that has taken place. People will say to you, oh, was it probably scheduled a year ago? No, it was put on particularly now to say to the West, don't forget, we are a nuclear power. And if you think you can just ignore this by going on sort of bit by bit, dissecting us and taking us to pieces, continuing to use Ukraine as a battering ramp to destroy Russia. And what that's saying is, you know, Europe is using Ukraine to prevent a settlement. I think that was so obvious during that period when Witkoff and Kushner were going back and forwards. I mean, every time, you know, the Europeans would call a meeting and then they bring Zelensky in and say, no, we can't have this. We can't have this at all. They have to continue. There can't be anything. There can't be a settlement. There can only be a unilateral ceasefire. That's all that is acceptable. And it didn't resolve the issues. The issue fundamentally about Ukraine is the same one. It's Russian security. They need to know what is the limit of NATO's, if you like. Where is the border of NATO? How far does NATO extend? And to say on the other side, this is Russia, China's Asian frontier. We have to have some understanding. You know, it just, NATO goes on and on, expanding, taking different views. And the Russians are saying, you know, we have to halt this. We have to have a serious discussion. So Karaganov's final point, I mean, is something fairly simple. We have to talk about this. We have to talk about, again, which we don't do and haven't done for some time. We have to talk about, you know, understanding each side's perspective on the nuclear issue and on conventional weapons. It may not end up in a treaty, but something needs to be managed. There needs to be someone who possibly is even a, you know, someone with some weight or standing in their society that can come and say, you know, this is how we need to understand each other. Let's have sort of entente.
Gary, if I could get you to pull that previous headline back up there, the one you just had about Putin will only use it as a last resort. That, I think, is more important than it appears at face value. I'd like your view on this. I know we're just about running out of time here. But taking a look at what this headline is here, reading it from Western eyes, Putin says only use nuclear weapons would be a last resort. So when we hear that, we think, oh, well, and unless we attack them first, then they're not going to use nuclear weapons. So we don't have to worry about it, all this kind of stuff. But it depends on the definition of last resort. You said a second ago, you got to look at the other side and think the way they do. We're thinking the way we do. But here is Karaganov. I perceive, and you tell me if you think I'm wrong, I perceive he's putting that definition of last resort in a different context. Here he is with Glenn Deason.
We have restored our soul and our honor. We have started to value those people in our society, which are truly valuable, meritocratic elites, scholars, doctors, officers. The country is becoming more healthy. But for that, we are paying for too many bodies. So my advice to my government is that we should stop this war, at least in Europe, by going up the ladder of escalation, first attacking by commercial weapons, symbolic or logistical points on European soil. We not need an inch of Europe, as you might understand. And then if they do not succumb, we should follow with nuclear strikes, relatively mass, with, of course, offering some kind of ultimatum. If they do not succumb, some of the countries of Europe should perish.
Now, whether Putin holds that view or not, I don't know. But when he says last resort, that means we'll fire conventional weapons at these points because of all the things that have happened in the last 4+ years. So when he says last resort, that seems to be different than what Americans are thinking. How do you see that context?
I mean, he puts it in the context of we need to learn the lessons from Iran. Iran used not necessarily the most powerful conventional weapons, but conventional weapons to send a very clear message, striking at a vulnerable asset, but not destroying everything, to send a message clearly and saying retreat. And largely the West did retreat. And he is, Karaganov is saying, very much the same message is saying, look, we've tried it verbally and said to, you know, we put statement after statement out saying we won't accept this. And people say, oh, it's bluff. We don't pay any attention. We won't pay any attention. We'll just continue. We'll continue on soldiering. And he's saying, if they don't stop, if they don't hear that we do have limits, that there are boundaries that you cannot cross. And if you cross those boundaries, first of all, we will deliver a pointed message in terms of a conventional weapon. If it goes on and you don't pay any attention, we may then use a tactical weapon to underline the last resort is that we are a nuclear power. I'm not trying to present the Russian case. I underline, I'm presenting the European case because I'm presenting the case that Europe actually has no interest in going down this route. It should actually come to some understandings about where the limits of security lie. Where are the limits of NATO action? Where are the limits that China and Russia and Iran can pretend to. If without that, I mean, it becomes chaotic and it becomes unmanageable and can easily deteriorate. We have no interest in sort of pushing this to the limit. Now, Karaganov clearly, and I say I've discussed it with him, he is creating a psychological atmosphere, but a real one. He's creating a psychological atmosphere. He believes it's important that Americans and Europeans understand that a deterrence is deterrent, and it has to deter. If it doesn't deter, it's a waste of time. And so he's trying to underline the importance that for Russia, nuclear power is seen as a major deterrent.
And just final question here, what is your best assessment for how close we are if Putin would do it, not Karaganov, but Putin would say, all right, it's crossed my red line. Europe has apparently no intention of changing anything that they've been doing for the last 4.5 years, that Putin would say, all right, that's it. We're going to try the Karaganov method, conventional missiles at various sites in Europe. How close do you think we are to that?
Quite close, if this escalation goes on. I mean, how many missiles? You know, first of all, it was Ukraine threatening the 9th of June victory celebrations in Moscow with a massive attack, which then Putin spoke to Trump, and Trump got it called off. And then we had a massive drone attack on Moscow, probably the one that was intended for the 9th of June, which was pulled back on Moscow. I mean, this is, you know, so yes, it didn't happen on the 9th of June. They just saved it up and did it a few days later. Either the Europeans pull back the Ukrainians on this and say, no, here are the guidelines. We have to manage this. You can't simply just escalate and escalate and escalate with drones and with, and as I underline, you know, these drones are storm shadows and drones. I mean, they are cruise missiles produced. They may be transshipped to Ukraine in crates and put together again in Ukraine. But fundamentally, these are European weapons being used directly on Russia. You can't get around that. These are European weapons facilitated and assisted to strike deep into Russia. How long does Russia put up with that? I don't think it'll go on forever putting up with that. I think it's been pretty patient so far. And as a European, I think we should respect that deterrence, and I think that deterrence is actually something that serves us, because we don't want the frog to get boiled.
Indeed, we don't. I couldn't put it any better myself. Thank you so much for coming on today, Alistair, and really laying this out in honest way. Just remind people to go and read this whole article on the Conflicts Forum. There's the address you see on the screen, conflictsforum.substack.com. And read all this stuff, because there's constant new material we put out there. So thank you very much, Alistair. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we appreciate you guys as well. There's going to be one more short show today. Something that's been kind of in my craw. You'll see it on the schedule here coming up shortly. Take a look at that. I'll be back off of the – we're going to do the intelligence brief tomorrow, by the way. We're going to still stick with that. So I'll do one more here. From vacation with my family on Saturday morning, the intelligence brief. Otherwise, we'll see you back in my studio Monday morning on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you then.
You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.